Zvuk misli.
Podcast Instituta za filozofiju i društvenu teoriju.
Dobrodošli u Zvuk misli. U ovoj epizodi imamo izvanrednu priliku da razgovaramo sa jednim posve nesvakidašnjim istraživačem, ali kako sam sebe naziva, gejmerom, levičarem i teoretičarem psihoanalize. Alfie Bound dolazi sa Royal Holloway Univerzitetu u Londonu, gde je predavač kulture digitalnih medija. Predavao je takođe i na Hang Seng i na Kineskom univerzitetu u Hong Kongu. Prisutan je takođe u brojnim i različitim medijima, piše za Guardian, Paris Review, Newsweek i druga izdanja. Bio je host podcasta o psihoanalizi i društvu pod nazivom Sci-Fi, urednik je u međunarodnom kolektivu Everyday Analysis koji se bavi studijama kulture, kao i na platformi Subration Magazine. Neki od naslova njegovih knjiga su The PlayStation Dream World, prevedena srpski kao Svet snova video igara u izdanju FMK knjige. Tu su i Post Memes, Seizing the Memes of Production, Enjoying It, Candy Crush and Capitalism, ali nešto manje pop, ali ništa manje izvrsna knjiga, In the Event of Laughter, Psychoanalysis, Literature and Comedy. Tako da sad ćemo preći na engleski. Hello, Alfie, it's very nice to have you here in Belgrade.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's great to be in Belgrade. Thanks.
Yeah. So let's start right away. And I wanted to propose you, like, we have no agenda. We don't have prepared plan of this discussion.
Yeah.
Maybe I have something like in very brief, lines, but I remarked that you often start your discussions like this one that we're having today with very catchy and provocative examples, you know, in the best sense of the word, of course. The examples of phenomena from the digital world, in relations to economy and politics, mm-hmm. and then you link them with the insights from psychoanalysis. That's how I see it, and then. Mm-hmm. And that's somewhat the way you write also, I suppose, I would dare to say, mm-hmm. But what I would like to propose you today, is to inverse things a little bit, to go the other way around. And I wanted to ask you, firstly, what first attracted you to philosophy and theory, broadly speaking, to thinking as labor, so to say, Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And maybe more specifically, what attracted you to psychoanalytic mm-hmm. theory and stuff?
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. No. As you're absolutely right. I mean, it's very kind of you to put it that way. But for me, it is basically I'm mostly interested in understanding sort of what's going on in the sort of digital world or the world of today. So I guess I usually start by thinking about those kind of real things, and then using psychoanalysis to sort of think about how we relate to them. But the thing that appeals to me about psychoanalysis and that made me want to sort of dedicate my studies to it was because, I think, I suppose I'd want to say like a kind of combination of Marxism and psychoanalysis. But it seems to me, I'm a sort of just about sort of millennial. I'm 36 on. What day is it today? Thursday? I'm 36 tomorrow.
Happy birthday.
I sort of grew up with, this is the generation that grew up with the internet. Sure. And it seems to me that we're also the generation which, my daughter is also fascinated by the fact that she grew up and the internet is there. She's eight, whereas I grew up alongside it or whatever. So yeah. I'd say that the two things that kind of characterize my generation are, firstly, having grown up alongside the internet, and secondly, having grown up in this period of economic decline. If you compare us, our generation, to our parents, and the kind of, as I've been learning over the last 2 to 3 days, it's a little bit different, the history here in Serbia. But generally speaking, there are parallels. And if you look at our parents' generation compared to ours and the kinds of forms of, the life we can expect, the kinds of recognition as well that we receive from our society. So a lot of the things that provided meaning and recognition in the psychoanalytic sense, you know, whether that's family or career success or a decent salary that means you can afford rent, you know, these are forms of recognition that our parents had that we don't. So I'd say that the two things that characterize this generation is this growing into the digital world and this decline in economic conditions. And what I think that leads to is new kinds of fantasy and new kinds of illusions, new kinds of beliefs that structure us, that allow us, that mystify, really, the crisis of capitalism. So that for me, that these two things go alongside each other. On the one hand, you've got the crisis and decline of capitalism. On the other hand, you've got the increase of the role of the digital as a new way of mediating this crisis, of asking us to enter into new forms of fantasy, new forms of belief, new forms of recognition to replace the older forms of recognition which have declined for this generation. And for me, you know, this psychoanalysis is a way of understanding, you know, the Marxism helps you understand the decline of the material conditions, but the psychoanalysis is needed to understand how we relate to these new forms of fantasy which try to, you know, cover up, trick us, make us believe and live in a different libidinal world of desire and recognition and fantasy. And I think you do need both to sort of understand. So when I read Marx, I thought, oh yeah, this is a correct analysis of economic mess of capitalism. But when I encountered Freud and Jacques Lacan, I thought, oh, I can now also start to understand why we relate so bizarrely, so weirdly to our own desires, to our own fantasies. You know, we really are in a complicated, messy digital world. And I think psychoanalysis can help us to sort of untangle and start thinking about, okay, why do we relate to our society, our objects, our things, each other in the way we do, particularly in this, for this generation, I think.
Yes, sure. But what I wanted really is like some kind of what was the personal drive, like to start to do theory, like very, 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 very simply put, you know, like, okay, we are sharing this experience. We are practically the same age. We share this experience, the both of the threads that you mentioned now, you know, but not everybody, you know, and everybody from our generation is in, you know, at least in this cultural zone, like Western Europe or whatever, West in general, like is sharing this kind of a common experience, but not everybody does theory, you know, to cope with that. So that's actually what I wanted to get from you, I mean, you know, yeah, if sure. It's not too personal.
No, I mean, it's not too personal. It's not too interesting and probably not too unique. But I was studying a degree. I was actually quite lucky. I ended up going to University of Manchester. Mm-hmm. And the only reason I went there is because I failed an exam and I couldn't get in anywhere else. So I decided to go. But I was lucky because at the time there was a sort of quite a lot of Marxist theorists in this department. Terry Eagleton was one of my lecturers in my first year at university. But it was really, actually, I really hated the degree. I didn't really understand why studying literature was important until I had one professor who's still a writer today. He's called Jeremy Tambling. And he really, you know, showed me psychoanalysis. And he taught a course called Emerging Modernities, which is kind of something like what I was starting to talk about there, I guess, which was basically Freud, Marx, and Nietzsche. And he argued that, you know, these things need to be together rather than separated.
Yeah, the school and of doubt, like.
Exactly.
Paul Ricoeur.
Exactly. And I sort of thought, well, yeah, I mean, I do think we're going into a different kind of modernity. And it just seemed to me that, yeah, I guess like many people, you know, going through, 18, 19 years old, trying to make sense of the world, you know, I think I probably already had a sense that, you know, it was probably at that time when you're 17, 18, you think you're going to achieve everything, you know, everything's going to come easily, recognition is going to come, you're going to be famous, successful, you know, you're going to have a house, a family, etc. And then, you know, but it was around that time I started realizing, well, you know, maybe I'm not going to get those things. And at the same time, I saw the theory as a way of thinking that, okay, well, this it helps me to understand why. And I think this is another thing that, you know, I don't have too much of a tendency, maybe it's because I'm a little too self-confident or something, but I don't have a tendency to like beat myself up too much about it. But I think that's because I've been brought up with this you know, theories. If you look at like digital media today, and a lot of popular culture, it's always turned on the individual. Change your lifestyle, change your habits, make sure you get enough sleep, eat the right things, do the right exercise. It's capitalism trying to turn back onto the subject. You're responsible for your well-being, and you have to take charge of yours. And I think what the reading those theories in my late teenage years did was show that actually you're part of a society, you're a symptom of a society, and the reasons why you're suffering is not actually because of you, it's because of wider material conditions and so on. And I think even as a young boy, I thought that sounded right, and also like a bit of a relief, because it's so much pressure to individualize everything. And so I was attracted to it for that reason. I think it's still the reason why I read these things and talk in this way.
Yeah, that's a satisfying answer. You know? Thank you. One of the central notions, like in your way of dealing with psychoanalysis, is the notion of desire, at least in your last book. So, why you concentrate on this notion rather than some others?
Yeah,
that's an interesting thing, I think.
Yeah. No, I think it's a great question. I mean, I'll tell you a fun way which I came into this. So I'm obviously going back to, as you described, the way I normally think about it. But it started with Pokemon Go. I don't know if you've ever played Pokemon Go.
No, I didn't. But
so in the summer of 2016, I mean, it really took over everyone's attention for a summer. Even Franco Bifo Berardi referred to the summer of 2016 as the summer of Pokemon Go. Sure. You know, so really, and I was in Hong Kong at the time, which was, as you can imagine, a bit like Tokyo, a place where people get obsessed with video games and start things. So I started playing Pokemon Go, and I started realizing that there was this real complicated kind of corporate structure here underneath the game. So one obvious thing that was in the news was that a lot of the poker stops were placed in McDonald's, and there was a deal between McDonald's and Pokemon based on like the number of Big Macs sold or whatever. And the rarest Pokemon was only in the most expensive shopping mall in Hong Kong. And this was part of sort of driving traffic to the shopping mall. So I started to think about this and study apps and how they move people around the city in new ways, basically. Sure. I saw Pokemon Go as basically, it was made by a company called Niantic, who were quickly bought by Google. Mm-hmm. They were then sold again. But basically, I saw it as Google's way of testing. Mm-hmm. To what extent can we control people's movement in the city? Yeah. Can we move them to where we want them to be when we want them to be there? And I started realizing there was a huge pattern. I studied WeChat, the Chinese app made by Tencent. Another kind of funny story was when I went to give a talk in Hangzhou in East China, and I was saying, WeChat, you know, it's evil. It has some features very similar to this, where it can see if a riot is starting to develop or a protest, and then it identifies ways to stop that kind of congestion or whatever. So they had these plans to stop people protesting by using the data on the app and stuff like that. Anyway, I gave this talk, and after the talk, a couple of guys came up to me and they were like wearing suits. And I thought, okay. And they said, oh, we're from Alibaba, you know, the big corporation. Yeah.
Sure.
And I thought, oh shit, you know, this is
this is not good.
Lawyers or something. And they said, oh, you hate Tencent, don't you? And I said, yeah, sort of, yeah. And they said, oh, well, you might love us. We're from Alibaba, you know. Sure. I mean, there's all sorts of interesting history, because Jack Ma, the Alibaba founder, is from Hangzhou. So there's local pride and things like that in the corporation, which is all interesting. Anyway, they took me to this place called Cloud Town, which is like Silicon Valley hub of Alibaba's headquarters. And they showed me all these latest technologies that they're developing. Hangzhou is like the oldest city in China, but it's also this like prototype smart city.
Yeah.
So it's like the new technology, such as traffic lights, which count the wrinkles underneath your eye and decide how long you need to cross the road, this kind of thing. Anyway, I said to the guy, okay, what's the most incredible thing you've got? And he said, it's this car. And he showed me this car, which is manufactured by Rover, the German car company, and Alibaba.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, so what's so special about this car? And I was expecting him to say, it can never crash, it drives itself, it's the safest car in the world, it's the fastest car in the world, it can fly, whatever. And he said, no, the car knows when you're hungry and what you might like to eat before you do. Okay. So I initially thought, that's nonsense, who cares? But the more I thought about it, the more I realized this is actually the most important thing about the car. So what it does is it syncs up with all the data from your social media, photos you've taken, GPS, credit card receipts. It learns everything about your behavior patterns. And for example, you fancy some sushi at 4 o'clock on Tuesdays. You don't realize that, but the car realizes that. And at 3:30, it says, why don't I drive you to this sushi restaurant, right?
Yeah,
and that's insane. And the reason they do it is to take people away from restaurants which use WeChat Pay or cash to ones which use Alipay. So it's part of their dominating the market by organizing people around. Anyway, this is all a very long way of answering your question. Why do I think I focus on the psychoanalytic ideas of desire? Because this is basically what Jean-François Lyotard called a desire revolution, right? Mm. It's a revolution in desire, but it's in the service of capitalism. And I think that we're in a particular moment where we can no longer trust our desires, because it's our desires which are the very locus of the way we're being transformed in this digital capitalist world of today. So a quick reference would be that, you know, the riots of May 1968, they relied on the, at the time, revolutionary idea that we should not let ourselves be limited, right? Live without boundaries, let our desires run free. And this would be the radical revolutionary position for a leftist or socialist subject to take. That completely doesn't work in the context of today, because it's through our very desires that we are manipulated
by the capital and technology right away.
The last thing we can trust is our desires. And I think that psychoanalysis is the form of theory which teaches you not to trust your desires, but to see them as connected to this enormous social economic world, and to think about it as a symptom of that rather than as your own desires to pursue.
Yeah, let's go back. We will go back like to the like conceptual level. But let's go back to your example now, because like that car, it makes me think, like, how is that different, like, from any like food delivery app that you have today that is sending you like emails, like what exactly when they think that you need to eat, or you want to eat, or you desire to eat, they propose you, they give you suggestions on email. You ordered that 3 days ago, maybe you will have fancy some more, you know, or whatever. And like, why? Need to like to add the car to that, you know, something that drives in real streets, you know, like, is that some kind of, you know, that the digital and the digital realm and the so-called, you know, physical, like, whatever, everyday world, you know, out of the phone, like, are they merging?
Yes, and I guess that's why.
Is that some kind of a symptom of them merging together? Like, with the traffic lights also doing the same thing, and like.
Yeah, and the Pokemon.
That's the argument.
Yeah, and it's exactly what I wanted to say when I did the sort of book on these things. It's exactly this kind of thing. It's not that, oh, this is crazy, look at this new unique technology that Alibaba has. More that this is the end result of what we've been doing, how our normal internet functions, the way there's so many ways we could think about that. We could even talk about things like Cambridge Analytica and the way elections and targeted voting structures happen, advertising since probably 2008, or we could think about targeted advertising and curation of personal feeds and things like that. It's all going on social media and in apps what interests me is the way that what all this sort of seen together, what kind of picture does this paint? And I think you're absolutely right, it is also about, this is no longer just in the digital world. You know, the Pokemon is actually in the street, you actually have to travel there, and you're experiencing, and this is why I often said that, you know, augmented reality, AR, you know, it's way more important than VR.
Yeah.
Because, you know, sometimes the things that capture the public attention, but I would say that a dating app is a great example of augmented reality, and many dating apps, you know, I mean, it's so interesting. It goes also to desire and thinking about this. We actually experience our relationships partly mediated through the app. The app doesn't just make you meet someone, but they restructure what relationships are so that part of, you know, the real life of there's nothing more real than, you know, meeting another person or sex or something. But the fact is that you can't separate sex from dating apps because we are living in this kind of world where this augmented reality, I guess, where these things structure how we think and feel and what we do and how we desire. It's extremely interesting.
Yes.
I mean, there's one guy, just while I think about it, I think his name was Evan Moffat, who was a gay journalist, and he did a lot of interesting writing about Grindr. I mean, Grindr is an amazing story anyway, because this crazy stuff with Donald Trump and China wanting to buy it, and then Trump trying to buy it back, you know, it really shows that capitalism comes first, you know, because you had like this, you know, Donald Trump, hardly a sort of champion of LGBTQ rights, trying to fight with the Chinese government, who don't even allow LGBT stuff to a large extent. But they both wanted to own the app because of the power of its data and the amount of money it could generate. But in any case, my point was that this journalist really showed that people in the early days of Grindr were actually going on dates and keeping the phone on, even often during the sex act or during the dinner, and the app will accrue points, rewards. It's, you know, you might get comments, you share it with others. So basically, you're sort of mediating your. And I think that's actually a sort of metaphor for how we all relate to each other now, with the digital sort of mediating.
Yeah, that makes me think. Actually, you know, like. What we are dealing then with, like, psychoanalytically speaking, like, what we are dealing then with that, what is that, you know, what is happening actually? Do we have the, you know, there is that argument that we live in the time of foreclusion, you know, where we just, like, foreclose one part of reality and we don't, like, acknowledge it at all? Are we dealing with that, like, some kind of a psychosis where we don't have the one part of reality? Or we have some kind of a jouissance, like the enjoyment in the production of sense. We have some surplus, you know. Yeah. What is the, you know, actually in that situation where, like, you are on a date and then you have a phone and still being on that app and doing stuff, you know, is that like diminishing the strata of sense? Or it is just adding layers. What is happening there? You know, are we living with too much sense, or the sense is like restricted? I would dare to propose that there is both things going on simultaneously. You know, that you lose something from reality, but then you gain something there. And what to do with the surplus and what to do with the lack.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I absolutely agree.
Is that the space of manipulation of where the power kicks in?
I mean I think that's a very interesting way of putting it, and I basically agree. I mean, it's very difficult. I don't quite know what I think, but my instinct is that it also has something to do with what we were talking about before, with the way in which we derive recognition from the world. And I think this goes back to the sort of overall sort of Marxist approach or whatever, the, you know, as
Hegelian one,
yeah, right? Even a Hegelian one. And as Marx said, you know, the bourgeoisie has, like, torn asunder all of the coordinates, you know, or that you know, the things that were solid that are now air, you know. So the coordinates which we used to use to structure social life and to derive recognition from the world, and relationships were situated within that network of things. So your marriage, for example, if you were to be married, did not exist in isolation, but as part of a wider social network, which to a certain extent made sense. What has happened here is the fragmentation of these things. And so, which is not, you know, it's neither bad nor good, as in Marx. It has to happen, but it also has to be seen for what it is.
I heard you calling the balkanization of...
Yeah, right. That's funny, because I haven't...
That's a provocative thing to mention.
To mention in Serbia.
In the heart of Balkans.
In the Balkans, yeah, because this concept of cyber-Balkanization.
Yeah, that was the term, sure.
Which another term from media studies you sometimes hear is this word splinternet. But basically, these are just sort of posh academic ways of saying filter bubbles. But the way the internet divides us up whilst using the same space is extremely interesting. And this sort of fragmentation of people from each other. I mean, that can sometimes be, I mean, and this again, I mentioned briefly the election things, but I'll tell you another funny story about these bubbles, this desire networks that I think is worth saying. Mm-hmm. So we obviously had Brexit, I'm sure everyone knows.
Yeah, sure.
and I'm sure it's obvious to people that if you were a sort of, liberal, let's say, everyone thought that Brexit wouldn't happen. And we've even had, I mean, David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister at the time, he's this week only brought back into the government. He allowed the referendum to happen because he knew we wouldn't vote to leave, right? Mm. Because he absolutely thought, so it was total shock that people did. Anyway, mm-hmm. So if you were to go on Facebook at that time and you were a Remain person, it just looked like everyone was Remain, right?
Yeah, sure.
And if you were a Leave person, and I remember this one time my mum was, my mum's sister is a bit more like a Brexit type, and my mum's a very hippie liberal type, and her sister had come to stay, and she borrowed her computer to log into Facebook. Mm-hmm. And then when she left, she forgot to log out. So the next time my mum goes to Facebook, it was accidentally logged in her sister's profile. Mm-hmm. And I'm downstairs and she shouts down, "Alfie, Brexit's going to happen."
And I thought, well, that's a good story.
And, wow. You know, suddenly you could see how this works. You know, it pockets people off in a certain way or whatever. And this is not a society. This is a, you know, and so for all we hear about globalization and internationalism and, you know, the breakdown of borders that were previously there, that's all just a sort of cover up for the fact that we're more alienated from each other than ever before.
Yeah.
And I think that goes to back to this question, very difficult question about why people are on their phones while they're also on a date, is because they don't know where to derive. We don't know. We can't derive recognition. We don't know where to get it from. We don't know. It's no longer enough. We feel this fragmented sense. Okay, the date's going well, but I also need to post it on Instagram, share it with my friends, get their feedback on it, get their encouragement. You know, and it's nothing new, but it's a new form of how we, and I think as society is struggling for its identity, probably like never before. And again, I think that comes right down to a very simple answer. It's the material and economic conditions. Without them, without decent, secure material and economic conditions, we will be increasingly fragmented and find it increasingly difficult to build a relationship, to fall in love, because we have this fragmented sense of not knowing what is recognition and where to get it from, I think.
Yes, of course, I think we hear this story of fragmentation, like many people speak about that. But what I'm interested in is what is happening in the bubble itself, you know? Like, what's that phenomenon, you know, of suggestions, like how that works? Because this seems to us like it's quite a new thing. But then if we look at some authors like Pierre Klosowski, like you probably know about the living currency. It's his masterpiece, you know, that Foucault thought was the best book ever or whatever. No, he's speaking in one part just of suggestion, and that like in the artisanal industry world, it existed, like it was done by paintings, books, and stuff. Then in the mechanized industry, he says that this is changing, you know, like the instruments of suggestion are changing, they start to change, and he's writing that in the 80s, you know, so no digital world yet, you know. I think it's 1980, you know, so the genesis of like individual fantasies and phantasms like are redirected already, you know, and like
no, I think it is a great and I actually think it probably dates more to, I mean, it's tempting, of course, to I mean, it is the time of the internet, but it's also do you remember this? I don't know if you had it in Serbia, but the switch over from analog to digital television.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it was a big thing in the UK, and there was really lots of scaremongering. Oh, my God, we're going digital or whatever. And then on one day, you know, the television switched over from analog to digital or whatever. Now, I think around this time, this is really interesting. I mean, I don't know if you had this. I mean, you will have different, I'm sure you'll have totally different cultural references, but maybe the same kind of structure. Mm. I remember, for example, there's an interesting thing about Britain. At 7:45 p.m., right, in the 80s and 90s, there was often a local power cut. You know when all the electricity goes out in the street? It just goes black, right?
Yeah.
And it's because there's a British TV show called Coronation Street. It's the oldest British TV show. It's at 7:30 till 8 o'clock. And at 7:45, there's adverts, and people go to the kitchen and they put the kettle on to make a cup of tea at 7:45. Now, too many kettles at once cause the power blackouts in local areas, okay? Another example would be from my own childhood. I used to watch The Simpsons at 6 p.m. And have my dinner at 6:30. And almost everyone in my school did the same.
You were running back from school to be in time for The Simpsons.
The digital switchover did, and of course, if you glance at Netflix or these filter bubbles, the curation of private feeds or whatever, what that moment began was the ending of those habitual cultural traditions. Why I'm really interested in like people like Guy Debord and Henri Lefebvre, who wanted to study like everyday life, right?
Yep.
Habit, pattern, ritual.
Yeah, he's speaking about rhythm analysis.
Kind of thing. Because I think it's so interesting that those rhythms existed. And okay, it's not hardly socialist to watch The Simpsons or make a cup of tea, but actually there is the sense of community going on there, and at least this kind of national scale. What happens with the suggestions that you're referring to of the digital world is that they're all individual. They are all, and I actually asked my students, completely personalized, which is sold to us as a fantastic offer. You know, imagine getting bored with, but it's I think the opposite. You know, people say, oh, imagine being bored by the adverts that are meant for other people. No, actually, I would be fascinated to see the adverts meant for other people. Yeah. and at least then there is a sense that we're receiving the same thing. And there's a, you know, I think that's the big thing that's changed, is that, you know, there isn't actually a consistent, you know, shared and lived experience, except not in this sense anyway, which I think is what the what's the word for it, the curation, the personalization, of our feeds, of our suggestions, the sort of bubbling up of things leads to this, and also it goes back to the thing that, you know, what it's designed to do is give you a sense of having been recognized, having been seen, right? It's you're reflected back, just like all our social media platforms, where people have 1,000 followers but they still feel like they're somehow getting these feedback loops of recognition through but it's everyone can have it on an individual level, but it becomes impossible to have collective social life in that kind of system, I think.
Yeah, sure. Maybe I don't know, but maybe this story of recognition has I think many things to do with the ways that in which we believe,
yes, exactly,
which trust things, and maybe there is like some kind of a switch there, because maybe in the time of television or whatever, we sincerely believed in those things, you know, and maybe there's some kind of a change in the regimes of believing and trusting stuff. So I think many people, or at least many young people, are very well, you know, I think they realize that their digital lives are happening in bubbles.
Yeah.
Many of them. But that doesn't matter. Exactly. Like they disavow it.
It's
like,
yes, exactly.
And it still works. So what to do with that? You know, like that's a huge problem.
It's a classic example of disavowal, isn't it? As you say. I mean, we all know these things. It's not like me saying them is going to make people say, oh, actually, maybe I won't, you know. but I think that's the question, isn't it? I mean, I know it's a classic example of disavowal. And like, don't get me wrong, I don't think that these, like, I don't even think that's wrong. I'm guilty of it myself. I might even post the occasional selfie, you know, or whatever, you know.
Yeah, just...
Or picture of us doing this podcast.
Yeah.
And all,
but why not? In the end of the day, you know. But that won't change.
No, exactly. and I think that. But I think the thing is, yeah, that is the thing. I mean, it is difficult to survive in this world. To, you know, and you can see it in so many different areas. You could see it in a sort of mental health crisis. You could see it in, you know, that it is actually a struggle, and you have to allow yourself whatever forms of coping mechanism you can. So this is also why I'm not, you know, I really try to avoid always being one of these like prescriptive, you should use this technology, you shouldn't use this one, this is bad, this is good. You know, I don't really have that sense, because I think that, you know, we have to have fantasy, and it's necessary to survive. We also have to have narcissism to get up in the morning, you know. So, you know, but I think what is worth saying and thinking about is just sort of pointing out that these forms of experience are, I think, quite fragmented, quite temporary coping mechanisms for the wider problem of the capitalist structure of today's society. They are not sort of long-term solutions or alternatives in any way. I think we do need to think about community and what, you know, well, we need to somehow get rid of some of these wider systems of capitalist systems that we live in order to start sort of living a less desperate relationship to fantasy and recognition, I think.
Yeah, maybe some places to search for comfort in that sense. Like there is in French theory, there is a big like tradition of thinking of community that goes from Bataille to Jean-Luc Nancy and people like that. You know, maybe some kind of a being single, plural kind of mode could help us think these things in a new way. I think we need some kind of ontological like restart. You know, you speak about. Like you speak about, let's go back maybe to psychoanalytic terms and speak about, you know, reformatting desire.
Yeah,
you're speaking about that, and of course you mentioned also désir évolution or whatever. This can happen in both sense, you know, like what can the left do with that, and what the right is already doing.
I've sort of lost some hope in the left, but I mean, as you probably know from I used to really write a lot from this perspective of why is the right being so successful in libidinally engaging people. And you know, as I briefly mentioned before, it actually kind of starts with the sort of liberal Obama elections and then goes to the Brexit and Trump, and but also in other ways, you know, like 4chan and the meme cultures around that. I'm very interested in all that, and this big question of why has the right succeeded to engage the subject in a libidinal way and perhaps even develop stronger community than the left has. And I think that is a really stark question for people to confront.
Yeah, but I, if you permit, like I think that they're like giving people the occasion to enjoy, in the sense, you know, they give them space to have that enjoyment in the production of sense, you know. That's why I have all those memes on the right, you know. I think that's enjoyable activity, you know. That's something that we really like to do, you know,
exactly,
like
exactly.
And I think maybe on the left there is a, as you know, that is maybe the heritage of, you know, critical thinking was so, you know, like I think maybe that's the symptom of the critical thinking being less, you know, operative today and less successful in some sense, you know. We need to maybe reorganize some things in that sense.
Yeah, I think that's
what
right.
What do you think?
I agree, and I think it has also something to do with comedy, which I guess is my other kind of topic that I'm interested in. You know, that I think we've sort of...
Yeah,
we've lost the ability to have the laughter of solidarity and community, and things are so tense. I mean, this is my current, you know, for example, you know, that you laughter, you know, if you take a Freudian approach to that, laughter is the thing which relieves tension. But actually, comedy is one of the most fraught with tension in today's society. You know, so there's been quite a complete shift from comedy as being a relief of tension, and therefore this kind of universal solid experience of solidarity, and into this kind of really, really sort of cause of tension rather than relief. And I think this goes also to the idea of a commons and piss taking. I mean, piss taking and joking about each other. I mean, if you compare the social media of the right to the social media of the left, the social media of the left is extremely careful. You can't, even one joke slightly out of line, you might find yourself blocked, cancelled, reported, blog posts written about you. You know, I mean, not that this matters, but it does characterize the atmosphere of the left, that it's this kind of treading carefully, and what that leads to, in my opinion, is no open debate, no open platforms. And I think it's important to be able to fall out, shout at each other, joke about each other, laugh at each other. You know, I think that those are fundamental things that happen in common public spaces. They don't happen in the privatized spaces of Facebook and Twitter and social media and so on. So it's one of the big misconceptions that we think of the new public as social media, but that's actually the new private. You know, that's not a public space. It seems like a place where people come together, you know, like to exchange ideas and thoughts, but it's actually characterized by being a private space rather than a public one. And everyone is their own, you know. And I mean, again, another thing is I was thinking when you were talking before is how social media has this role, because you are a lacking subject, and that is the most elementary insight of Jacques Lacan's psychoanalysis, right? That we are all universally lacking subjects. And not that Lacan was a Marxist, but there, if you wanted to, is where to find the sort of universalist value of Lacanian psychoanalysis, in my opinion. There, you know, of course, there are many people, for example, many feminists or many people interested in race, who have accused Lacanian psychoanalysis of being it's been accused of being too white, too male, too upper class. It's been accused of all those things. But actually, if you think about it from another way, it's fundamentally universalist, because the one thing we do all share is this lacking subjectivity. What social media does, you as the user are the only lacking one, and everyone else appears to be complete. Right.
Sure.
And I think that leads to this culture of tension, anxiety, and carefulness, which, you know, is not the spirit of solidarity and a commons. And if you look at the way, I don't want to say too many positive things about the right, but if you look at the way they interact on Reddit or 4chan, it is actually much more of a space of an open space of a commons in the tradition, a digital version of a commons, you know.
Maybe there is though so much discourse policing
inside
the right, because they're policing already
yeah.
the others, you know. they're really concentrated on the external enemy. Yeah. So, you know, that's one of the...
I mean, that's exactly right.
Dangerous.
Exactly. No, I mean, you know? But both are bad. I mean, you know, absolutely, that's exactly the right thing. What characterizes the right there is this externalization of the enemy or whatever. But what characterizes the left is this weird puritanical fear of the wrong one getting in, you know.
Yeah, it's a neurotic situation.
Yeah, it is.
It's quite a neurotic situation.
It's very neurotic,
And we're not living anymore in the time of neurosis. That was Freud's times, you know. Like, we are now, I think, in a much different kind of psychosocial realm, and we don't adapt to it in some kind of sense. I would like to get you to another notion now, like, and please do link it with the digital world, like dreams. That's the other one that you're like, how do you see as an analytic and an emancipatory potential in the phenomenon of dreaming.
I think this is such an interesting topic, because I actually came to this question, dreams, like in two separate ways. So obviously Freud's very interested in dreams, and I was interested in that. The other one was when I was thinking about this idea of video games as dreams, so that this is really the first book I did that was about, I called it the PlayStation Dream World, which mm-hmm. was basically about what is the relationship between, you know, new digital technologies such as video games and dreams. And there's some similarities or whatever that can be drawn in a playful, not so serious way. But the other thing that I became, that got me into this topic was Walter Benjamin's concept of the arcade.
Okay, right? Okay. I wanted to get to that. Thank you for the Benjamin.
So,
we all love Benjamin.
Yeah. I mean, so interesting because, you know, the arcade, we refer to video games arcade as an arcade. Mm-hmm. But really they come from the 19th century, you know, these kind of iron and glass structures that Benjamin analyzes in this huge arcade project. You know, yeah. What he basically argues, not really argues, but what the fragments of Benjamin's interpretation is basically exploring how this space that is an arcade produces a new kind of dreamlike commodity capitalism. So you enter into the arcade and it's like a department store, I guess would be another 19th century example.
Yeah.
And you're not in the same world of desires as the outside world, so-called outside world. And I think that's what I wanted to explore with the digital spaces as well. Things like social media and video games, you enter into a kind of Benjaminian arcade where the same rules don't quite apply. Mm-hmm. People are liable to do things that they think things and feel things that you ordinarily wouldn't. So you sort of suspend your reality and enter into these interesting spaces, and we're spending, I'm not just talking about like a obvious example like the metaverse or whatever. I'm talking about every time we pick up our phone,
yeah
you know, we're entering into one of these kind of dreamlike spaces which is designed to modify and codify our relationship between each other and objects in a new way. So what I wanted to do there, just one last comment on the dreams thing, would be that one of the insight from Freud that I find the most interesting is that dreams, you know, he goes through all this thing, dreams are a repressed wish, dreams are a repressed childhood wish or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the real thing comes when he says, and Lacan kind of builds on this as well, but he says that like the dream seems like it's your own dream, but actually it's got these other coordinates elsewhere and so on. And I think that's, and in Lacan, he uses the distinction between drive and instinct in this way, right? So instinct, it's like when it sort of comes from within, but drive, he says something like, drive is like a kick in the ass or whatever.
Yep.
So it's when something propels you in a certain direction, but you feel you've propelled yourself in that direction. And that's where it goes back to getting in that car that Alibaba made or going to get that Pokemon or whatever. Because it seems that one of the fundamental misconceptions or functions that capitalism plays is to propel you in a certain direction and make you feel like you propelled yourself there. And I think, and it sounds, you know, even people going to protests this week and waving flags is also embedded in this system, right? Not that you shouldn't do it, but that we're all living in the system and we forget that. We think we're active agents when we're often not. And, you know, Freud's and later Lacan's kind of discussion of dreams is also like this. Yes, it's you and you're part of it and you inserted your subjectivity into this fantasy world, but it's not. It's also cultural, political, economic, and this is how you should sort of see and negotiate that space. And I think that's something we kind of need to be reminded of often, because in a way, I think we're all, you know, I mean, we're in the middle of various global crises at the moment. I don't want to like talk too specifically about that, but we're all in a fantasy. We're all in a dreamland when it comes to how we relate to these wider things. And I think that needs to be sort of made visible more.
Yeah, and that is where the technology, like, which is like financed by some huge capital, you know, that is where the so-called techno-feudalists like come in and organize our desires in the dreamlike world, you know, like it's prepared in some kind of a sense. We are just
sometimes
maybe you gave some arguments now, like just that like psychoanalytic theory is often accused of being too subject focused, and now you give us another picture, like no, it's quite socially, you know, let's say influenced or thinking society as a phenomenon more broadly. Yeah, there is Yeah, that's the Los Guattari story where they're, you know, building up on that. You know, I'm counter that argument that the Los Guattari were hating Freud or whatever. You know, yeah. You can hear that and Lacan and whatever. I think that's not so simple as that. You know,
yeah, I agree.
Just they're building on it, and maybe those can be.
It's funny you should say that because I mean, just personally, I the first I ever heard of Lacan was my lecturer who I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. He gave me Anti-Oedipus, yeah. And I was looking at their critique of Lacan and psychoanalysis as being fundamentally based on lack. For them, mm-hmm. it's possible to have a desiring subject that isn't structured around lack.
Yeah,
that's
a huge difference. Yeah. Yeah, sure.
That was what led me to think, oh, Lacan is interesting, you know, and that. So actually, I came the other way from Deleuze. But I agree with you that people are always, you know, a lot of the Deleuzians, you know, they don't see how closely connected. And there's a great book by Aaron Schuster on Deleuze and Lacan, which explores this. I think they are closely related. I definitely think that.
I think it's an injustice to say that. You know, like
they're not enemies. Yeah.
No.
Yeah. No. Agree. No, and I think, but I do think on this particular point, you know, that. The idea of a subject defined by lack, mm-hmm. right, it seems correct to me, and you know, one could disagree, but I do think that if you take that universalist idea of psychoanalysis, it's strange. It turns out that the psychoanalysis, the one that was accused of being least class conscious, least feminist, least global in terms of race and nationality, turns out to be the way of thinking that's least oppositional and most universalist, and that is what I think psychoanalysis should and can be.
Yeah. So this is a very, very nice place, like, to end with this praise of psychoanalysis, and so I want to thank you, Alfie, for being the guest of the Sound of Thoughts, and I hope to see you again in Belgrade soon.
Yeah. No. Thank you so much for having me. It's actually been an extremely interesting conversation. So yeah, really, really nice to be here, and thanks so much.
Thank you. Hvala što ste slušali Zvuk misli i vidimo se sledeći put. Doviđenja.